watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQC, Warrenton, Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren, Gary. It seems strange to me that all of a sudden, immigration has been trumpeted as such a big problem that Congress feels compelled to use taxpayer money, including the taxes paid by immigrants, to build walls across the U.S. borders. This in the wake of a group of armed racists calling themselves the Minutemen, patrolling the southern border, hoping to accost people crossing from Mexico. I call them racists because they aren't patrolling the Canadian border, where presumably only Anglos would be crossing. And thus I conclude that they are motivated not by issues of law and undocumented immigration per se, just the immigration of Latinos, who are fast becoming a majority culture in the Southwest. It's important to understand that immigration laws have long had the purpose to control the ethnic composition and cultural character of the United States. These laws were at one point directed against people from various European countries who were considered undesirable. Here's an example from my own family. Both my parents were immigrants who came here as children from various countries. My mother had come here alone as a refugee from the fascists in Italy. My grandmother was not allowed a visa to immigrate here. Why? She was born in Hungary, so she was considered a Hungarian, and the quota for Hungarians was filled. So she spent World War II hiding in an attic, going out only at night, posing as a deaf-mute beggar. I have no use for sanctimonious utterances on the subject of legal versus illegal immigration. This is all one planet, and people should be able to migrate where they wish or where they must. But controlling the movements of populations, keeping them in or keeping them out, is just one of the ways that privileged groups use nation-states and their borders to maintain an oppressive human hierarchy. They stir up witch hunts against defenseless groups that are made into scapegoats, and thus deflect anger from the rulers. Immigrants or other identifiable minorities have repeatedly served this role. The Jews of Germany, who Hitler purged as some dangerous alien influence, had been in the land now called Germany since at least the Roman Empire, a couple of millennia before Hitler was born. And the Mexicans' native ancestors have been here in Turtle Island for tens of thousands of years before the ancestors of the Minutemen arrived on these shores from Europe. In previous chapters of the reading I've been doing from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, he explained how the developers of compulsory state schooling wanted to impose certain cultural values, those of Anglo-Saxon Protestants, on the children of immigrants in order to prevent challenges to the existing order. Various social movements challenging class power and privilege were sweeping across Europe in the 19th century and swept into America with immigrant populations. The exploitation of immigrants when they arrived here only fueled class-based social activism, such as the labor union movement. And as we'll hear in the first hour of the program from feminist scholar Sylvia Federici, witch hunts, and I mean the original ones against women alleged to be witches, were also based in struggles about power, profit, and hierarchy as capitalism came into being. And we'll follow Federici's talk with another reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education and its development by what he calls true believers as a method of social engineering modeled on European systems designed to preserve class stratification in society. Dr. Silvia Federici is the author of Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation, as well as other writings on capitalism and feminism. The talk we're going to hear next was recorded at the Commons Conference last April in Victoria, British Columbia.
What I'm going to do in the 45 minutes that I have is trying to give you some idea of the main arguments that I've developed in Caliban and the Witch. And also, I'm going to try to show to you, you know, why the question of witches and witch hunting is an important issue for us today. And even though it seems to belong to a very far distant past and seems to somewhat be, falling to a world in which so many more precious, important issues are now at the foreground, of our concern. So this is what I'm going to try to do tonight. And I have to say that the difficulty in making the issue of witch hunting important is also due to the fact that this phenomenon has been so misinterpreted, so understudied, that many people still associate, witches with creatures that belong to the world of folk tales. Many people do not believe or do not realize that, in fact, thousands and thousands of women have been persecuted under the charge of being witches and, tortured, exterminated, and, as I would like to show, that their persecution, the persecution that was waged against them, has a lot to teach us, not only about the past, but also about our own society. And in particular, has a lot to teach us about the development of capitalism, the nature of capitalist relations, and the position of women within it. Right? So again, this will be my topic tonight. And I have to say that the women's movement certainly changed the image of the witches. And in fact, it kind of subverted, the traditional image of, the old lady that kills the children and is ridiculed as well as, has been turned into a source of amusement on Halloween Day. And in fact, with the women's movement, the witch became a symbol of female revolt, and became a symbol of the independent woman, the woman who is autonomous, the woman who is strong, the woman who is in rebellion against the church and against the state. Later on, you have, the women who practice Wicca, who also have revalued and glorified, the witches. They have revalued them and interpreted their persecution as the persecution of women who were practicing a very old religion, a kind of nature-based religion, a religion In other words, they saw the witches as the descendants, you know, of the priestesses of the great goddess. Right? And in that sense, again, you know, they took the witches as a symbol of, you know, their struggle and their beliefs. Now, I come from a different position. You know, the work that I've done on the witches, and in particular on the great witch hunt of the 16th and 17th century in Europe, has taken a different approach. I've not been interested in studying, you know, the 16th and 17th century witch hunt and the later witch hunts that have also taken place. I've not been interested in studying them in order to find a figure with whom to identify, and I've not approached my studies of witches with the idea of you know, glorifying these you know, women, you know, as particular symbols of revolt, but rather I wanted to understand the reasons for their persecution. To me, the most important part of my work has been trying to understand why thousands of women in the course of 2.5 centuries in Europe and later in different parts of Europe's colonial world were persecuted and were accused of the most abominable crimes, beginning with the crime of having made a pact with the devil and following that pact, having committed the most atrocious deeds, sucking the bones of children, killing their neighbors, poisoning their animals, and in general, you know, dedicating themselves to the pure perpetration of evil. I've been interested in understanding the reasons of this phenomenon. They seem so fantastic, so difficult to explain. You know, so difficult to explain that when you begin to read this material, you know, you often feel that, you know, it's beyond explanation, right? But the very, for myself, the very existence of this persecution and the incredible fact of the pain and the suffering of all these women, you know, who were killed, who were tortured, who were terrorized, who were humiliated, right? From the very start told me that something very important was at stake, something again very important, not only from the viewpoint of our understanding of the past, but also of our understanding of the present. You know, doing historical work, and particularly, you know, studying history of struggles and histories of persecution, you develop an attitude that leads you to see the past as constantly present. You know, and this, in fact, has become my attitude, you know, towards the witch hunts of the 16th and 17th century. Those women are still with me, they are still with us. I feel their presence now in the sense that they have not been revenged. Their pain and their suffering is still being, to a great extent, unspoken. And nobody has ever paid for what was done to them. And they are like the many, you know, the many historical people who have been decimated, who have been persecuted, right? And the world has continued, you know, and, you know, the world has continued, and but we cannot afford to forget, right? We cannot afford to forget them, because to the extent that we forget them and we don't understand, you know, what was done to them and why it was done to them, you know, again, we are bound to find ourselves in the same situation and find in a situation where history is constantly repeated. So who were the witches and what was the witch hunt and why it is important for us to study it and understanding and what does it tell us about our society as well as the society in which the persecution occurred. As I said, this is not an event that can be immediately interpreted. Right? They lend itself to a very direct interpretation. But at the same time, this is true of any important historical event. I cannot think of an important historical event that can be immediately explained on the basis of direct evidence. You always are in a position in which you have to use all kinds of clues, and you have to reconstruct the past in order to make it speak. And this is what I'm going to try to do, even in a very, you know, limited amount of time. Now, the clues that we can use to understand the witch hunt are, first of all, the consequences that it produced, you know, and particularly for women's lives. And I believe also, you know, beyond the effect of on women's lives, right? So looking at the consequence, we don't have, in other words, to read the mind of those who persecuted them, those who tortured them. But we can understand the significance and the meaning of that event by looking at its consequences, its effects, right? We can, of course, try to decipher, you know, what the witch hunt was by looking at the type of crime, at the type of women who were persecuted, right? And we can also use all the knowledge and experience that we have of our present, from the present, from today. And this, in fact, in my case, you know, I was it was very important that a large part of my research, you know, was done at a time when all around me I could see, you know, unfolding the process of globalization. Because, in fact, that process, looking at what we call globalization unfold, you know, in the United States as well as other parts of the world, you know, continuously gave me insights into what must have happened, you know, at the time of the persecution of the witches, and vice versa. In fact, I reached a situation in which there was a continuous exchange between what I was reading in the book and the research that I was doing and what I was experiencing around me in terms of the politics of the globalization process. Now, another development that has been important, you know, to gain insights into the witch hunt, and more recent, has been the so-called war on terror. And I want to say a couple of words on that, although I'll try to come back, I hope to come back to it during the question period. You know, the witches were the terrorists of the 16th and 17th century. Right? And, you know, the witch hunt was, in a sense, very analogous to, in many ways, to what the war on terror is today. And, for example, as you probably know, I'm sure you are aware of, that the concept of the terrorist is now defined in such a broad way that can be used to persecute a very large variety of crimes, even though those a large variety, excuse me, let me correct myself, can be used to persecute many different types of behavior, which the state wants to see criminalized. And I want to start my discussion of the witch hunt to say that this, in fact, was the case, you know, with the definition of women as witches. You know, witch became the label for evildoer. And under the label, a very large variety of types of behavior could be persecuted, even though on examination, on closer examination, you can see that those types of behavior were somewhat interconnected, and that, you know, the attack waged on witches as the attack waged on terrorists, right? And the use of terrorism as you know, as a charge, right? You know, in the end, has a very definitive, has you know, purpose, objective, has very definite objectives it tries to reach. Right? A couple of things here, for instance. Now, you know that today a terrorist can be defined as, in the United States, according to the Patriot Act, as a person who seems to be trying to influence the policies of the state, you know, by their behavior, right? So even though obviously there are in the world some people who use terror as a political weapon, clearly under the label of terrorist, right? Under the label of terrorist, many, many people, in fact, probably most of us, you know, can be charged with that. You can, in fact, strikers, it is often, you know, strikers have been described at times in ways that makes them very close to terrorists, protesters, anti-war protesters, and so forth. Okay, now, you find in the persecution of the witches of the 16th and 17th century that, in fact, you know, the very similar situation, you know, was at work. You know, the label of witch became a label that, you know, was sufficient, you know, to have a woman arrested, tortured, and executed, even though no proof of crimes committed might be available, you know, against her, right? There's another, by the way, there's another connection which I think is interesting. You know, witchcraft was defined as a crime. It was called a crimen exceptum, which means a particular, a special type of crime, a crime that is exceptional because it's so bad that you are allowed to use any procedure against those who are guilty of it. In other words, the regular procedures are suspended, were suspended in the case of this particular crime. And we find, again, an interesting parallel to show how past and present continuously merge with the war on terror, where, in fact, in the case of the so-called terrorists, too, you know, the regular procedures are suspended. And, for example, torture has quite openly returned, you know, to be considered a legitimate part of juridical procedure. Now, the most important clue that, in my view, we have to understand what the witch hunt was and its connection to our reality is the time period in which it occurred and the social context in which it occurred, right? And here I'm going to ask you to make a brief journey with me to travel back in time, and even though, you know, we may be thinking of a situation that occurred centuries ago, to bear with me and try to think back to events that, although far long past, you know, were very important, and they've been important, very important in our history. Now, there are 3 dates that I want to propose to you that I find very interesting. The first is the date of one of the first major demonologies that were written in Europe against witches. And the date is 1484, excuse me, 1486, and is the date of this book called The Hammer of Witches, which I advise for it's a very educational book. It's a classic in misogyny. It's full of hatred against women, and you ask, in fact, you know, what these women must have done to provoke such hatred. It was written by Dominican monks, members of the Inquisition in Germany, and is considered a very, very important text because it launched the persecution in Germany, and then basically became a classic. Everybody read it, it was published many times, and so forth. So the date is 1486. Now, 1486 is also the date of the Sentencia de Guadalupe. The Sentencia de Guadalupe is an agreement that was signed by the lords of Catalonia and the king of Spain, and it's the Sentencia of Guadalupe put an end to serfdom. It was the document and the agreement that basically put an end, you know, to officially, formally, to the condition of serfdom. And the third date is 1492. 1492, the departure of Columbus, which began the conquest of America. Right? Now, I take these 3 dates as symbolic, and of course many more dates could be assembled, but I take these 3 as symbolic because they indicate that in a way, you know, the witch hunt basically stands, right? Its beginning occurs at a time in which profound transformations were taking place in European history. You know, a whole world was being transformed. And in particular, it took place at a time in which you had the culmination of the crisis of the feudal world. You know, a crisis that basically was not an evolutionary crisis. It was a crisis that occurred as a result of a prolonged process of struggle, a prolonged process of peasant struggles that basically opposed the aristocracy, demanding their freedom, demanded basically the autonomy, would refuse the conditions of serfdom, refused to be serfs, wanted to have their land, wanted to have their community, wanted their community to be independent. And that struggle also was joined by, you know, artisan workers who wanted to be free from the control of merchants. So we have a period in the 14th century in Europe in which the whole feudal world begins to crumble, enters into crisis under the impact of this struggle. And the date of the Sentencia de Guadalupe, you know, or the Sentencia, gives you an image, you know, of how powerful those struggles were. In fact, by 1400, serfdom, which was the main form of exploitation in Europe, was coming to an end, and not only in Spain, right? And with that development, you also have the beginning now of a sustained attempt by the European elite, by the dominant classes in Europe, to regain their power, right? To regain their power, to regain their command over the accumulation of wealth, right? To regain their command over the workforce and to find new resources, to find new workers. And in fact, the conquest, the beginning of a geographical exploration, which in this period is continuous. They are continuing to exploring, but they are exploring really, as you know, because what they were really exploring was where they could appropriate resources and workers that would enable them to overcome their crisis. And of course, they discovered America, in quote. Right. Now, the witch hunt is in that period, or at least begins in that period, and then develops for two centuries, hands in hands, with the process of conquest and colonization of America, and at the same time, hand in hand, with the process whereby in Europe, you know, thousands of peasants were expelled, you know, from their lands, communal relations were destroyed, and, you know, a market economy began to take shape. And it also went hand in hand, you know, with the process whereby by the 1500s, 1520s, you know, you begin to have the beginning of a slave trade, which, of course, accelerated through the 16th century and culminates in the 17th with the development of plantation economies in the Caribbean and in the south of the United States. Now, so those connections, those dates, that context, you know, became clear to me, it was very obvious. It was became axiomatic for me to assume that there was a very profound connection between the witch hunt, the slave trade, the expulsion of the peasantry from its land in Europe, and all processes that I knew had been key to the development of capitalism, to the development of capitalist relations, you know, in Europe and in the world. In fact, to the development of the first world economy. Right, the development of the first world capitalist economy, because I agree that you know, capitalism was born as a global economy. Globalization did not begin in the 90s. Globalization began when European elite annexed the America, you know, to Europe, and basically appropriated the resources that had been, you know, they were available on the American continent, and you know, harnessed them for the development of a market economy in Europe. Now, the question, of course, now is, what did the witch hunt specifically had to do, you know, with the rise of capitalism? If it can be established, as I believe it can, that there is a profound connection, you know, between the persecution of the witches and the slave trade, the process in England and other parts of Europe that has been defined as enclosure, right? You know, what was the objective of the witch hunt? What is the relationship? What specifically that persecution do? You know? Now, I claim in the book that the answer cannot be univocal. You cannot just have one answer. Obviously, the witch hunt had many effects and had many purposes. And as I mentioned before, It was instrumental, right, to the accomplishment of many tasks. And certainly, you know, one that stands out, you know, very in an outstanding way is that the witch hunt was instrumental to the attack that was being waged, you know, on peasants in particular, as well as artisans, you know, through many countries of Europe, in which the process of shifting to a market economy, a capitalist economy, was underway. And you have, you know, this was a period in which the workforce, you know, was extremely embattled and under assault and attacking many women, mostly lower class women, poor women, right, and accusing them of being evildoers, of being witches, of being committed to plotting every evil deed against their neighbors, was very powerful tool to try to weaken the forces of resistance of communities that were under attack, right? And to create a climate of fear and reciprocal suspicion, right? Imagine if you can be convinced, if a community can be convinced, right, that a man itself, there are women who at night, you know, perpetrate, you know, who are basically demonic and perpetrate all kinds of evil deeds, right? That kind of suspicion generates, obviously, a division, generates a weakens, you know, the resistances of that community. And this clearly occurred. And we also know that the majority of witches were women who were poor, were beggars, right? Women who had lost everything, they had lost land, particularly they were older women. And, you know, this was, of course, at a time in which begging was seen as anathema, right? And particularly with the rise of Protestantism, poverty begins to be seen as a sin, as a sign of sinfulness. And begging, in fact, begins to be banned. You know, in a previous era, begging was accepted. In fact, charity was one of the activities that was expected of people with some wealth. But with the development of a more capitalistic, you know, work ethic and the society, begging begins to be suspicious. So we know that certainly many women who were accused of being witches were beggars. Some of them were healers. And healing, too. Obviously, the fact that women were practiced folk healing, you know, the attack against them can clearly be understood, because that healing gave them a certain power in the community, right? It gave them, in fact, the healers were considered extremely important, extremely useful member of the community, and, you know, gave women a power that obviously, you know, had to be broken. So all of these factors are important and have to be taken into account, and I hope that maybe we can also talk about them more in detail in the second part of today's, you know, discussion. But I want to now focus on the main arguments that I've tried to develop. And I'm very interested in hear what you think of them and whether they appear as convincing to you as they have eventually to me. And what I mean by that is that there are some specific development in the process of you know, the development of a capitalist society, some specific processes that, in my view, are especially important, you know, for understanding the witch hunt, right? And one in particular is the development of a new attitude towards work, and consequently a new attitude towards workers, and a new attitude towards demographic issues. What I mean by that is that, you know, with the shift to a capitalist society, and here again, I do not think I'm saying anything new, you begin to have a ruling class, you begin to have a dominant class that looks at work as the most important element in the accumulation of wealth. And in a sense, restructure society, restructures the economy from the point of view of developing relations, developing social relations, developing economic relations that are most conducive to the accumulation of labor, that are most conducive to the exploitation of labor. And that new conception of labor as the source, the main source of wealth, right, can be shown to have affected the view that the ruling class in Europe had also of population. In fact, throughout the 16th and 17th century, you begin to have an ideology that looks at population as the main wealth of a nation, right? And an ideology that basically sees, believes, and teaches that the more workers, the more wealth. And that, in fact, as a result, you know, changes also the attitude towards procreation, the attitude towards natality. And the argument that I develop, and there is an argument that now is shared also by other feminists who have studied the witch hunt, is that, in fact, one aspect of the witch hunt, right, one explanation for the witch hunt is the attempt of the ruling elite, is the intent of the employer class and the state, you know, in the period that led to the transition to a capitalist society, to basically take over the body of women, and take over the body of women with the purpose of controlling the source of labor, of controlling the very source, the very instrument for the production of new workers. And in other words, what I see the witch hunt as performing, and here where the parallel with the slave trade becomes important, is that the witch hunt becomes an instrument, right, for the attempt by the state to control women, in particular control the reproductive powers of women, to control the women body. And it did so to the extent that the witch hunt criminalized, even though in a seemingly fantastic way, but it criminalized, you know, what we would call today, you know, reproductive, you know, any attempt of women to control their reproduction. And for example, many witches were accused of causing abortion in women, of causing impotence in men. In fact, the image of the castrating witch was a classic of killing children, above all, of being an infanticide, you know, a group devoted to infanticide. And so those accusations, in fact, which have led to the definition of the witch, you know, as a woman, you know, generally old, that it's the enemy of children, right? And of course, has had a lot of consequences on the literature. For example, how many children's stories have been built, you know, around this hostility of the old woman to the child. That one way that can be explained is by seeing that this accusation occur in a background, you know, occur in a context that was beginning to look at, you know, procreation as extremely important, you know, from the point of view of its economic utility. And therefore, you know, was attempting to establish a very direct control on the procreative process. It's very interesting here, and I think that it's revealing that in the period that we are referring to, through the 16th and 17th century, mind you, the witch hunt begins, you know, the first trial begins in the 15th century, but it really takes off in a massive way in the 16th and the 17th. Right? Now, in this period, very, very, very significantly, the second crime for which women were imprisoned and executed was infanticide. In fact, a whole new legislation against infanticide, you know, it's introduced in this period in the legal code of several countries of Europe. Right? And there's a very, very clear connection between the persecution of the witches and the severity with which infanticide began to be again punished in this period. So, you know, one way to put it is to say that the witch hunt was an instrument, right? Was an instrument in the state appropriation of the female body and an instrument, right, by establishing capital punishment for abortion and for the control of reproduction, was an instrument for the expropriation of the women's body, for the transformation of the women's body into an instrument for the production of workers. And I would claim, and I hope I'm not taking too much time in making this point, but I would claim that this is an aspect of the capitalist discipline of women that has continued, you know, long after the witch hunt. In fact, in many countries of Europe, infanticide was punished with death until the 19th century. And as you know very well, that the state attempt to control the body of women is by no means ended. In fact, even in the year 2006, and even after the women's liberation movement and so forth, you know, we still have in a situation in which the state at all level is fighting to control the women's body and also to control the production of life. In fact, the boom in reproductive technologies that we have witnessed, you know, in the last 20, 25 years, and the attempt of the state increasingly more and more, right, to reproduce life also in separation to the extent to as much as they can or they would like to from the female body, right? It's again, in my view, part of this process you know, the transformation, you know, of reproductive powers into economic resources, into something that can be used and put at the surface of the accumulation of wealth. Now, This aspect of the development of capitalism is not the only one, however, that is important to understand the witch hunt. And I want to mention three more that I believe are, you know, crucial, as crucial, and closely related to what I just, to the one that I just mentioned. The second is the development of new work discipline. Right? With capitalism, and here I don't have to tell you. I don't have to tell you that capitalism has intensified the work discipline, intensified and the regimentation of work, and has tried to regulate every aspect of our life, our body, our energies, our psychic and physical energy, and put them at the surface of work. And in fact, has developed an ethic whereby work is religion. Work is supposed to be the most important aspect of life, and every other aspect of life has to be subordinated to the performance, you know, of work. And here too, the past is like the present. The present is like the past, right? Because for all the technology that has been invented is supposed to meant to liberate us, you know, we now work more than ever, right? But that process of intensification of the work day and the work process begins, in, of course, with the development of capitalism in the time that was, you know, coeval, you know, with the witch hunt. By the 16th century, this was already well advanced. And so you have an attempt already. You have a ruling class that now basically looks at all aspects of life, popular games, popular sports, communal occasion, communal festivals, from the point of view of eliminating them as wasteful, and looks also at sexuality as something that has to be controlled and has to be curbed and has to be allowed only to the extent that is productive. And in fact, you begin to have an attack on every form of sexuality that was considered non-productive, that is, non-procreative. And clearly the witch hunt, right? In fact, the witch became the symbol of the lustful woman, you know, of excessive lust, and of the woman who was lustful beyond control, who copulated, you know, even with the devil. And clearly, again, there is a connection between that demonization of sexuality, and particularly the demonization of female sexuality, and the new kind of work discipline that was being implemented. Now, okay, oh my, this is terrible. This is terrible. I didn't even, oh, this is terrible. Okay, I'll have to try to. I didn't realize the time has passed. And okay, so I left to make my other point more schematically. But I'm the third point that I want to make is the third aspect of capitalist development, and in a sense, perhaps in one way, is the most important. Is that with capitalism, right, with the development of capitalist society, you know, you have a process that is structural to a capitalist society, which is the process whereby the work that goes into the reproduction of life and to the reproduction of the workers is completely devalued. In other words, with capitalism, you have a kind of economic restructuring whereby, you know, only the kind of work that goes to produce for the market is considered work, is considered important, and is considered worthy of a compensation, and carries with it a certain social power. Now, by contrast, every kind of activity that is useful for the reproduction of human life and useful for the reproduction of the capacity to work now is declared as non-work. Right, and At the same time with the development of capitalism, all reproductive activities became feminized. And here I could elaborate on this issue, because what we see in the 16th and 17th century is the gradual expulsion of women from wage labor. In other words, as you have a society that develops and that begins to develop a shift to a type of work relation based on wages, right, you also have, you know, a process of reorganization of the division of labor, whereby wage work becomes not only work, period, but becomes male, where it becomes predominantly done by men. Whereas all the activities that go into the work of reproduction, you know, are become the prerogative of women, but also at the same time disappear as work. Right? So that with the development of capitalism, you have the development of a division of labor whereby women and men, the work that women and men do, becomes more and more different, more and more differentiated. And where the division of labor becomes also the basis, the foundation for a hierarchy of labor, a long gender line. Right? And it's a hierarchy that clearly is constructed and then maintained through this following century through the wage relation, right? In other words, with the development of capitalism, you begin to have a new division of labor that makes women and men more different in terms of their activity and also creates the basis for the subordination of women to men and creates the basis for the use of the wage, right? A particular use of the wage as the wage becomes a tool for the subordination of women, for the control of women. I want to make the point, and the point that I wanted to develop tonight is that the violence that has characterized, you know, the violence that has characterized, you know, the relationship between women and men in a capitalist society, you know, it's very much embedded in this relationship. It's very much embedded, you know, in this disparity between the condition of women and the condition of men, and in the subordination of women, you know, to men by means of the wage and the lack of it. And now, back for a minute to the witch hunt, and then I will want to make the connection with the later history of capitalism. Back to the witch hunt. It's very interesting that if you look at the ideology of the witch hunt, one theme that is established is that there's something wrong for women to have money. In fact, for women to have money is the devil that gives money to women. There's something demonic in the relationship between women and money, right? And in fact, one of the women of the figures, female figures that was most commonly persecuted as a witch was the prostitute. Right? The prostitute becomes a kind of the symbol of the evil woman because, again, she is the one, you know, who is paid, and obviously that association of money becomes extremely suspicious in the case of women. Right? Now, the witch, I want to stress the point, and then I'll move on to speak because I want to make the connection also with globalization today. And I want to say that the witch hunt per se in itself did not cause this transformation. Right? In other words, the transformations, right, the devaluation of reproductive labor, the confinement of women to reproduction, the hierarchy of labor between women and men on the basis of the wage and so forth,